You need not look up these chapters. You all know them off by heart if you love God's word, and you've been saved more than a year or two anyway. Isaiah 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above it stood the seraphims. Each one had six wings. With twain he covered his face, with two he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then said I, Woe is me, woe is me, for I am undone, I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips. And I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphims unto me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar, and he laid it upon my mouth and said, Lo, this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin purged. Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? And who will go for us? Then said I, Here am I. Send me. And he said, Go. Tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not. I would like for us tonight to look at the sin of the prophet. Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips. And I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. I do not know of any sin in the 35 years that I have been saved that has done more harm to the work of God and caused more hurt among the people of God than the sin of unclean lips. I do not know of any sin in the 35 years that I have been saved that has done more harm to the work of God and caused more hurt among the people of God than the sin of unclean lips. James says to us in chapter 1, verse 26, If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain, it is worth nothing. If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. And in chapter 3, James actually says that the foremost proof of holiness,
the foremost proof of holiness, of vital reality with God, is a man's ability to refrain from entering into any conversation whereby he becomes defiled in the sight of God. The foremost proof of holiness, of vital reality with God, is a man's ability to refrain from entering into any conversation whereby he becomes defiled in the sight of God. He says in verse 2, if any man offend not in word, if any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man. The same is a perfect man, God says. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body, to control the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths. We put bits in the horses' mouths that they may obey us. We put bits in the horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships which though they be so great and have driven a fierce winds, yet are they turned about, whithersoever the governor listeth. Oh, behold also the ships which though they be so great and have driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beasts and of birds and of serpents and of things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed of mankind, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison, God says. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Do you think God exaggerates when he says something? If a tongue offends God and man, is not controlled, it's an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Oh, how much good has been destroyed by the tongue of Christians. Oh, how much good has been destroyed by the tongue of Christians. You need not take a knife and stab a man in the back to murder him. You need not take a knife and stab a man in the back to murder him. Oh no, brother. You may lose your testimony doing that. Oh, many a man has been murdered more cruelly. Many a man has been murdered more cruelly by the tongue of Christians. Many a man's testimony has been murdered forever by one sentence. Many a man's honor, many a man's usefulness in the pulpit of God has been destroyed forever by the tongue of Christians. I met up with some very godly people who serve the Lord from America. And they told me of one of the conservative theological seminaries in your country, one of the esteemed Bible colleges, seminaries of a very conservative denomination in your land. And they told me of the principal of that Bible school. He was so revered because of his godliness and his life. He was loved and revered by many multitudes of people in your land. He was the principal. Two students in that seminary one day spoke about him. And they spoke as if whispering. Whisperers always whisper loud enough for others to hear. They spoke loud enough for others to hear of this man. And what they said suddenly, like a tidal wave, spread
at the lips of Christians who didn't check whether it was true, didn't wait. Accept immediately anything and pass it on. And their sin is as great as the ones who started it. And suddenly, the shame of what was whispered in one sentence or two was spread across this land. And this principle was asked to get out. To get out. Not only of this Bible school, but of the denomination. He was told to go. His family was so shaken, they disowned him and pushed him out of their lives. Years went by, and one day those two students couldn't take the guilt anymore as the Holy Ghost began to deal with them, and they couldn't sleep in the nights. And they came back and admitted and confessed they had lied. They had lied. The leaders of that church, in shame, as the shame went across this land, when people realized how easily and readily they had just taken anything said of man and passed it on as if it's the truth without any searching, until the man was destroyed. They went trying to find this man. Search began throughout this land of America, in the cities where they thought they might find him and heard he had been seen. His family searching in desperation, his children smashed in their heart that they had looked at him, condemning him and not wanting him as a father. Wrongly. Searching. They did find him. In the gutters. In the gutters. Destroyed. They took him, begged his forgiveness. His family took him, begging him for forgiveness. But that man was so destroyed mentally. He's in the gutters to this day. You need not go out there and commit adultery, brother, sister, before you need to cry out, woe is me, before God. You just have to say one sentence. Just one sentence is all the devil needs to destroy a life forever. Forever. Oh, Isaiah. Isaiah. His sin is great and had to be dealt with. And you know, when he knew the greatness of his sin was when he knew he was in God's presence. Many Christians don't feel any guilt no matter what they've done to people, no matter what they've done and destroyed of people, even people in the pulpits, until they have something to do with the presence of God. Many a man will cry out, woe is me, who sit in the churches of our evangelical conservative churches. They will cry out, woe is me. The moment they become conscious, they have to do with God and not man. Many a man will cry out, woe is me, concerning the sin of this prophet, the moment they're conscious of God's presence in their life again. Oh, Isaiah. Isaiah became conscious he was in the presence of God. He had to do with God. And the cry of woe came upon him. The grief of his sin just suddenly escalated that he was undone. He was undone. The grief of his sin, the magnitude. He felt undone in moments in the presence of God. I wonder how many of you sitting here tonight are conscious you're in God's presence suddenly. And grief is in your heart as you're crying out, woe is me for the sin. As you know you have to do with God. Isaiah immediately cried out in shame, confessing his sin, and immediately as he confessed his sin and shame, he was cleansed by God. And you and I, if we confess our sin in the same way as Isaiah, in brokenness, with a woe, with a grief, undone by it, not just glibly. Oh, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins, to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we would just come to God in such a way, confessing, that God could deal with it and will deal with it. Because no cleansing comes on sin that is not dealt with. According to this book. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, God says, and able also to bridle, to control the whole body. He's in victory. There's holiness. The foremost proof of holiness is a man's ability to refrain from entering into any conversation whereby he becomes defiled in the sight of God. One of the greatest revelations God ever gave to me of the Christian faith was when I one night was sitting in a meeting like you're sitting here tonight. And the man in the pulpit, conscious I was in that congregation, looking at me, began to attack me publicly from the pulpit of God. It was like a moment he had just been waiting for, and he couldn't control himself. He just attacked me publicly, challenging my integrity, challenging my ministry, the fruit of my ministry, the worth of it, challenging me as a person. I sat there and I began to shake in fear as I thought, this man is intent on destroying me right now. He's in the pulpit and nothing else is in his heart but to destroy me totally. Oh, my heart went down. I don't know whether being right with God, whether being filled with God, the Holy Spirit, means you cannot be wounded and hurt at the wrongs of others to you, but I was wounded. I was wounded. I was so grieved. Tears just began to flow down my face as I trembled. And I thought to myself, oh, how can this man believe such things of me? How is it possible this man could believe such things of me? At the end of that meeting, I got up and I tried to escape from the building before the prayer closed, but I didn't. The amen came and I was still in the auditorium. And I suddenly realized a cloud of grief and sorrow had come upon the whole convention. As people just looked around for me, and everyone, when they saw me, I saw the tears flowing down their eyes of some of our leaders in Africa and the church in Africa. As they began to make their way toward me, people just touching me, saying, Keith, he destroyed himself, he hasn't hurt you. But I didn't want to speak to man. I wanted to be with God. I just wanted to get away from men. I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to hear anything. I just wanted to speak to God. And I wanted to get away, and I pushed my way through the people. Tears still coming down my face. I was grieving. I was wounded. As I got outside of the building into the dark to get out in the garden, suddenly I saw three preachers who stood there and wouldn't let me get past. As they confronted me, their grief and their indignation and their anger at what this man had done from the pulpit, taking advantage of the pulpit of God, destroying the whole convention virtually by what they did. They were so grief-stricken at the cowardice and the unethicalness of what that man did as they stood there angrily. Grieving at what this man had done to me. I stood there unable to pass them, and people began to just pile up behind us in quietness. They stood in throngs just listening to these men in their anger at what this man had done, expressing their grief. And just as I was about to speak, just as I was about to react to what had happened to me that night, my father-in-law, who's also a preacher, one of the most loved preachers of our land, he was in that convention and he saw what was happening, and he pushed through the crowds and he came and stood in front of the three men that were confronting me. And he looked at me and tears were coming down his face. It had not been easy for my father-in-law to hear what had been said from the pulpit against his son-in-law that night. It had hurt him. Tears came down his face and he looked at me and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said these words, "Keith, my boy, I hope you know what's going on here. I hope you know what's going on here, Keith. Listen to me, my boy. We're all in the school of God. The moment you get saved, you're enrolled in the school of God. You're in school, Keith. God's school. Some of us are in sub A. You call it grade A. Some of us in standard 6, grade 7 or so. Some of us in matric, grade 12. Some of us on university level," he says, "in the school of God. We don't know what level we are, but we're in different levels in the school of God. And Keith, it's the same as secular school when you're in God's school. Every standard you're in, you have to face tests. You have to face tests. You have to face examinations, my boy, in the school of God." And Keith, if you're at school and you face examinations and you fail, do you know what happens? You have to go through those examinations again. It's the same in God's school. Don't doubt this, Keith. Don't doubt this. I know this. My boy, you're facing a very severe examination that most of us haven't had to face. But listen to me carefully, Keith. Pass this exam, or you're going to go through it again, I guarantee you. Pass this exam in a way that if you pass it in God's eyes and men's, Keith, and men are watching you, boy, men are watching you, you pass this exam or you're going to face it again, I guarantee you. And he turned and he walked away. And suddenly everybody walked away at what he had said. No one had a word to say after that. And I was at last alone. And what that godly man said to me, the whole perspective of everything that had happened just changed in one moment. I saw everything in a totally different light. The next day, after the morning meeting, it was announced that in the afternoon, the whole convention was going to go in a convoy of cars and vehicles and travel across the city, a great city, to another venue, a big conference center where we would gather and join up with people who were also meeting that side in like mind. And they said at this particular time, everybody must get every vehicle available, every motor car, every van, every combi, everything that there is. And everyone meet at this time. We're all going to get in and go so we don't get lost to get to the venue across the other side of the city. We all go together and get there on time. Well, I was late. Somehow I got held up. And I suddenly realized I went in the passages of all the dormitories, everyone's out, and I began to run. I came out and all the vehicles were idling, waiting in case there's any latecomer, and I was the only one. So I came down and I looked for a car that I could get into. And I didn't know what to do because every single vehicle was full to capacity. They were just squashed into the cars.
And there was not one space for me, so I was walking around not knowing what to do. Eventually a hooter goes right at the back of all these cars, these motor vehicles, as far as your eye could see along these big parking area. And they hooting, and people began to point. It seems to me there's a car, I've got a place for you in the back. So I began to run because I'm holding the whole lot up now. And as I got to this combi, this van that had a good 10 men in, I slowed down and my heart began to sink as I looked in, because the only seat available of all those cars, the person sitting next to me was that man who tried to destroy me the night before. That was God. That doesn't just happen, brother, in the school of God. That's God. Oh, their faces just sank in absolute despair when they saw who it was. And they realized, I have to sit next to this man. I mean, his face just went snow white. But I had to get in that car, and I sat next to him, and there was deathly silence in the car. No one spoke a word. The whole convoy just started driving off. And I saw in the rearview mirror of the driver, the eyes of this driver, as he's looking back. What am I going to say to this man that did this to me? Here I'm sitting next to him now. So I looked out the window, and I prayed, "Oh God, give me grace that I don't have God. Give me grace that I don't have to pass this exam, God. Because I don't want to have to go through this again. It'll kill me. It'll kill me, God. Oh God, give me grace to pass this exam in God's eyes and men's eyes. And men are watching me. Men are watching me now, God. In Jesus Christ's name," I said in my heart. And I turned and looked at this man who was looking at me. By this time, the Holy Spirit had smitten him with conviction, and he knew how wrong he had been concerning what he said. I didn't have to defend myself. The man knew how wrong he had been. Obviously, he was sitting there in a state of remorse and fear, his eyes just looking pathetically in fear at me, his little lips quivering. And I touched his arm. And I said, "Sir, I love you. I want you to know I love you, sir. And I want you to know that I will be praying for you earnestly, for God to bless you and honor you. And you know, he knew as he was looking in my eyes that I was not being obnoxious. He knew that I meant it from my soul. And I saw in one moment something I will treasure for all eternity. I saw a man who tried to destroy me with every faculty of his being. In one moment, I saw respect because I passed the exams. Because I looked to God for grace I didn't have, and he gave it. I could have given him back what he had given me. I could have rebuked him for the cowardice and the unethicalness of what he had done, taking advantage of the pulpit. And he would never have respected me. I would never have seen that which I now treasure. That if you look to God for grace to pass the exam, no matter what has been done against you, men who hate you in one moment will respect you. And I have become conscious that God is obliged. He has a holy obligation. He has a holy obligation to give all the grace that is needed, no matter how trying the circumstance or whatever examination or test or trial you are facing in life, that you have all the grace available if you want it to pass the exam for the glory of God. But you've got to want it with all your heart. I often have had occasion to think back to what my father-in-law told me that night about this thing of being in the school of God is like secular school, where you
have to face examinations, and if you fail, you have to go through the whole thing again and face the whole thing again until you pass. It's just like secular school. And I thought back when he said that to when I was at school as a boy. We didn't have homeschooling those days in our country. We were at school, the public schools. And I remember one year I failed at school. I don't think it was because of a lack of intelligence. I honestly was a little bit confused about why I was at school. I thought it was for sport. I loved every sport there was, and I just threw my life into sport. I thought life was a game, you know. My mother and father despaired at me because I just didn't think studying had any significance. It's a waste of time. I mean, everything else was a diversion from the real reason I was at school, was my sport. Well, it caught up with me, and one day I found out that I failed my final exams at the end of that year. I failed, and I failed badly. It caught up with me. You can't get away with that. But the horror that gripped my heart as a child came back with a vengeance. And as I sat there thinking about this thing of being in the school of God and failing in the standard of the school you're in, the horror came back with a vengeance. And it was like I went through the whole thing again, and I remembered what the horror was. I remembered that we started at school right from the beginning, all of us together, boys and girls. And we learned from the same teachers, the same things we learned together. And then we all wrote the same exams. We all passed and went to the next standard. We all had the distant teachers teaching us new things. We all were growing in knowledge. We all faced the same exams. We went as we passed to the next. And we went year after year, all those. I started with these as little 6 year old, 5, 6 years old. Now we were all teenagers. And suddenly, when I realized I failed, I realized I was suddenly left behind by all that started with me. I'd been left behind. And they were conscious they'd left me behind. You can't not be conscious, but there's just a sudden conscious we've left him behind. He's left behind. It's so blaring, but it's the fear that gripped me as a child, conscious that I was left behind. And everyone knew it, everyone going on. They were being taught new things, growing in knowledge, facing new exams. Here I was going through everything I'd gone through, learning all over again to get to the place where I could face the same exams that I'd failed so miserably. Do you know, in the school of God, you can't hide when you're a failure. When you're failing the exams, you're left behind. You just stand out in the grief as everyone's conscious. It started off with you as you just left behind spiritually. Paul speaks of it, you know, this horror of being left behind, of failing the exams. You, now at this point, I should be able to give you strong meat spiritually for men. Here I may be having to take back and feed you as babes with milk. And laying the first principles of the faith, taking over the basics, whereas by this time you should be going on. Here I have to start again. Oh, it's a grief when you're a failure in the school of God, brother or sister. It's not a light thing, it's a grief to fail in God's school, the exams God sets to such a degree that you become known as a failure. I had an uncle. My mother had 8 brothers and sisters. And we had a big tribe of a family, let me tell you. But my uncle Moon, can you imagine calling a man Moon? They called him Uncle Moon because he didn't have any hair on his head. Which is this big round moon, you know. He was a very big fellow, by the way. All his brothers and sisters, and they excelled, and they were all achievers. You can't believe what they accomplished. But Uncle Moon was known as the black sheep of the family, and he was the first to acknowledge it, but it delighted him. Uncle Moon just lived for one reason, to make the world laugh, and boy, did they laugh. He longed to get the world laughing. I saw people just looking at him, beginning to cry with laughter, just looking at him. Because they just knew this fellow's just one big joke, and he loved to tell jokes. He lived for the occasion of just making everyone laugh. He had a heart of gold. He only got saved just before he died. But oh, we did love Uncle Moon. I'll never forget, on Sundays, we weren't a religious family, and on Sundays all the family would come, all the uncles, aunties, all the cousins, big tribes to mommy. Once granny died, it was always around my mother they gathered. And the other side of the family too, and we'd all eat together, and then all the grown-ups would be in the lounge. And the children weren't allowed in the lounge.
There to be all playing, all us cousins, all boys and girls playing around until it got dark, and in the lounge the grown-ups would speak about politics and sport. Only those two subjects were allowed to be spoken of. We would play, but eventually every Sunday night we'd come to the place when it was dark, when we'd come to the doorway of the lounge and looking at all the grown-ups. We looked for Uncle Raw, Uncle Moon. And we'd call him, Uncle Moon, come, come. Didn't take much, not much to tempt Uncle Moon to leave all the grown-ups, you know. This big fellow would just get up and come to be with the children. We'd get around him in the room and all around him, sitting on the bed and his arms around him. We loved him. Tell us jokes, tell us stories, you know. He used to tell us stories of the war. Oh, I felt sorry for the Germans. He was a prisoner of war. But what he did, oh. Dear Uncle Moon, we would scream with laughter. And so we were there one night and he was talking about this thing. Somebody was saying they failed. He says, you failed at school? Don't worry, Uncle Moon failed all the way through school. Don't be worried. He said, you know, Uncle Moon was so bad at school that when I started school, I was always bigger than the other boys, he says. And other girls, I was a little bit bigger. Look at the size of me, you know. I won't tell you how big he was, but he says, I started bigger than all. And at the end of the school year, I failed miserably. And everybody went up and a whole lot of other little boys came and I was bigger now. And I failed again. And I failed again. In the end, it was so embarrassing. They pushed me up. I didn't have to pass. You see, they push you up eventually, he says. In embarrassment that you're so big, you know, being with all the little boys and girls. He says, then I failed again. And again, I failed. So the government and the education department had a terrible difficulty to know how to work out a pension scheme for someone still at school. That's terrible, you know. I think he was joking. I hope so. But you know, it is a terrible thing when someone always fails. Every test they have to face, every exam is just a failure upon failure. Do you know how many Christians are like that? Do you know what a tragedy it is? Whatever circumstance is created by the devil and gone out by God, and you are now in a test and you're in an exam, they always fail. Always they fail and they fail and they fail and they fail and they fail. In the home, they fail and their children see. They fail to their wife. They fail to their children. They fail in the church. They fail in the work. They fail. They just fail. With the lips. The one thing that tells the whole world whether you're a failure in every other aspect of your life is the lips. God says. You know the saddest and most tragic moment, the saddest and most tragic moment of all in the school of God. The saddest and most tragic moment of all in the school of God. Is when I suddenly realize, and everyone else around me realizes, I've just failed the exam God allowed me to face. I've just failed. And that moment is realized more than anything else, when out of these lips come words that should never have come from a child of God. The saddest and most tragic moment of all in the school of God is when I suddenly realize, and everyone else realizes, I've just failed the exam God allowed me to face. And that moment, more than anything else, is realized when out of these lips come words that should never have come from a child of God. It is tragic. It's a tragic moment when you suddenly realize and everyone else realizes that you have failed God with the lips. And if it isn't tragic to you, if it isn't tragic, then that's a greater tragedy. You know why? Because then you don't care. You just don't care. If it isn't tragic to you when these lips fail. I was once in a very great convention. And there was a missionary woman in Africa who was so revered because of her godliness, her Christlikeness. I'd never ever heard her say a derogatory word about another human being. Of all the years I watched that woman serving God, she only had kindness. She once said to me when I was young in the faith, what you cannot say to a person's face,
what you cannot say to a person's face in love and for the glory of God. You cannot say it all. Because if you do, you are a coward and a grief to God. Oh, she set a standard for me that I embraced and lived because of her standard. In this great convention one day, sitting at a large table, were a number of preachers, some of them the greatest in our country. And I was sitting there, a lot younger than now. And this woman was at that table, loved and revered by all because of her life. Suddenly, two of the preachers at that table began to scandal, began to talk about somebody that wasn't there to defend themselves, as they began to undermine his integrity, began to challenge his whole integrity in such a way that he was going to be destroyed by those two men, by everyone at that table, if we believed. And I knew what these men were saying was not true, because I knew that man far better than they knew. I knew that this man was about to be destroyed, that no one at that table was not going to be negatively affected for the rest of his life by the lies, by the wrong these men were saying in their ignorance. And I sat there as they began to talk about this man. Somehow they just preachers they were. I got into such a state that I could hardly swallow my food. And I was just about to challenge them when suddenly this woman of God suddenly caught up in the atmosphere. You see, you're facing an exam when you stand anywhere near scandalmongers. You're the one in the exam. Anyone failing with the lips when you're near them, you're in an exam, a terrible exam, because that woman just caught up in a moment in the atmosphere of these men destroying the soul who wasn't there to defend himself. She forgot that she had said these words in that moment: what you cannot say to a person's face in love and for the glory of God, you cannot say it all, or you are a coward and a grief to God. She had said those words, and as she was caught up in this atmosphere, she suddenly shook me when she suddenly started adding derogatory words and caught up in pulling this man's character down to pieces. And you know, I was hurting and grieving at those men, but when she failed, I sat back in such shock and put my knife and fork down, and I sat and looked in such shock and shame. I didn't mean to condemn her with my eyes. I didn't mean to judge her, but she looked at me, and within seconds her eyes welled with tears. A few seconds later, she began to groan so that the whole table sat in silence. She bowed down and she began to sob violently, grieving. She got up from the table as the whole table stood to see what is going on. I knew what was going on. She walked right through all those hundreds of people at the eating tables of that convention, who all stood because of who it was, walking out weeping, loud sobbing. She was so crushed. It's a tragic, tragic moment. That moment, you realize you failed. And everyone else around you realizes you've just failed the exam God allowed you to face. It's tragic. And if it isn't tragic to you like it was to that woman, you are a tragedy. A tragedy in the school of God. Nothing else. That is tragic indeed, because that means you don't care at all that you fail in the one thing God proves you really are a failure. In the school of God, I've had many teachers, godly men and women who themselves were in the school of God, but they so excelled in passing the exams as they went through the school of God that they became teachers, they became examples of the believers.
in word. In word.
If it doesn't work there, it's not mentioning anything else. You could be an example of the believers, sir. Because that's the evidence that you are in control and victorious on every other level where the devil would have you sin. In word. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, God says. If any man, woman sitting here today, offend not in word, that's a holy man, God says. The same as a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. He's in control. He's in victory. That is a victorious life. You can be sure of it. Tell me, are you an example of the believers? How many years have you been saved? How many years have you been on the road, lady? Sir.
Are you an example of the believers with the one thing first? Nothing else you can mention if it isn't this first, in word. Because if any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man.
But are you, sir, lady? One of those who just fail. A man of unclean lips. That doesn't care if he's not crying out, "Woe is me, God. Woe is me."